Let me make a number of core points. I'm going to start with a quick summary of some recent research on impact, on the impact of digital technology, just based on some new stuff that's just come out. So here, I'll just throw it at you. Average child in America spends more time consuming electronic media than going to school. Okay, number two. In terms of parents, some recent research shows that while 6 in 10 parents worried that their children spend too much time in front of a screen, 7 in 10 children worry that their parents are the ones who are spending too much time in front of a screen. It's such a frequent complaint I hear from kids over and over again with a lot of pain. When I give them a chance to talk about it, they feel hurt, they feel abandoned, and it's a real issue in terms of that aspect of chinuch, that aspect of parenting. Let me just talk to you a drop about what we now know about social media. Subtle things. Most of what I want to talk about in the time I've been giving is the subtle things that happen to our sons and daughters in terms of technology. With the advent of social media as being so important on the mattering map of our sons and daughters who are tuning into it, here's what we know. Number one, that there's teens who spend more time than average on screen activities are more likely to be unhappy, okay, and in general show higher levels of depression. They're much more lonely, even though that sounds like a contradiction, because as we just heard, there's no depth. They also are more likely to feel left out by their peers. And one of the things that I've been thinking about just from what we just read is the whole idea of what Yaakov tells his family and his army in terms of being ready for the important encounter with Esav. He says, be ready to address the following three questions. L'mi'ata, v'ana seilech, u'mi'ela lefanecha. Who are you? Where are you going? What are you going to do with what you have? Rav Yosher Ber Soloveitchik talked about this al pidrush as being tied to something that we all have to do in our life. We all have to be able to take a step back and to answer those questions. You have to know who you are. That's at the core of what we want to teach our children about themselves. We want them to know who they are, about the chashivas of their family and of their history and of their community. And the research shows that when you have a strong sense of connection, it's an incredibly important source of resilience. And our kids are getting that, according to the research, less and less. V'ana Selech, where are you going? To be able to answer the question of where are you going with your life? What are your goals? If I had everybody here spend 20 minutes writing down, what are your goals in terms of the best possible outcome for your lives 10 years down the road? To think about the best, most unbelievable kind of goals in terms of realizing your dreams. And I had you do that for 20 minutes today, tomorrow, basically for 4 days in a row. Two things will happen. Your happiness levels will shoot up for a couple of months, and it'll make it more likely that you'll meet your goals. Umi'ele lefanecha is obviously incredibly important in terms of being able to answer, again, who are you, where are you going, what are you going to do with what you have? It's core. It's becoming harder and harder for our children and our adolescents to find the answers to those questions. In fact, I'll share with you a study. I've shared with it before. July 4th, 2004, Science Magazine, one of the leading scientific journals around. They take people in a series of 11 studies. They put them alone in a room, and they say, think about your life. What they do is they take their cell phones away, okay? They take it away. They take away any kind of phone, any kind of communication they have. They have them sit in a room with four walls and just a chair, and they say, think about your life. Think about where you're going. Think about what your goals are in the future. And they had them spend all of 12 minutes doing this. That's all they do, okay? And it's not surprising to hear everybody hates it. They absolutely hate doing this. Not surprising. It's hard for people. I doubt it would have been hard 10 years ago. It certainly would not have been hard 20 years ago. It's being versus doing. It's what we do on Shabbos. What was all of Shabbos about? Shabbos is about being, about not doing. But here's where the study becomes fascinating. They take another group of people, and they put them in a room again. You know, you're going to be here for about 12 minutes, and we want you to think about your life, where you're going, what you're going to do with what you have. And they say, oh, by the way, they take a small electric shock machine that delivers mildly painful electric shocks. And they teach them how to use it. And here's what they say. They say, look, sit here alone with your thoughts and thinking about being as opposed to doing. But if you get really, really bored, you could give yourself this mildly painful electric shock. Do you know that 67% of the men and 25% of the women chose to shock themselves rather than being alone with their thoughts? And yet we need that stillness in our life, as we just heard so brilliantly. We need to have that internality. We need to have the ability to go with that depth. We need to grow our children's neshamas by having them comfortable with being as opposed to doing. And that's unfortunately being subtly robbed in today's, especially with kids who have technology that exposes them to these kind of challenges. Okay. A little bit about Hergel, to bounce off of what we just heard, okay? Here's what I want to talk about, because it's not so obvious. In World War II, there was a terrible problem. We weren't winning the war at the beginning. It was a very close fight. You could only imagine how history would have changed had we not prevailed. And the first major problem hitting the armed forces of the United States was that one out of four men were unable to kill the first time they were in combat. Imagine what that means. We were losing effectively 25% of our fighting force. They'd go into combat. Baruch Hashem, it's not so easy to kill. They just couldn't do it. And it was a disaster. So they hired a team of psychologists and other mental health workers whose job was to teach men how to kill. And they did it, and they did it successfully. Baruch Hashem, they did it successfully. As horrible as a thing as it is to say that, we were able to do that. Vietnamese War comes, and they're ready with the same training program. They start the same program. You know, we have to make sure that our men are able to kill. And they found very quickly there was absolutely no need to have training to teach men how to kill in the Vietnamese War. Why? The answer is going to be obvious. Television. It was the first generation in history that fought war after exposure to television. By the time the average Vietnamese soldier faced the enemy, they had seen thousands and thousands of murders on television. And that hergel, that habituation, made it into not such a big deal. Okay? It's an incredibly important thing to think about. There are first shooter games that our kids are playing. One of the most popular today is Fortnite. I was asked specifically to talk about Fortnite. I apologize to anybody here who's a big Fortnite fan. You have to give me mechila, okay? So here, huh? So Fortnite is a first-person shooter game. It is extremely popular in our community. What happens with Fortnite is you basically build forts, and it's a very active game. It engages your imagination. It engages your koach hadimyon. It's not just a passive game, but at its core is you're together with 100 people, some of whom you know, some of whom you don't know, and the job is to kill them. They're cartoonish characters. Your job is to kill them, and you are the victor if you're the last man or woman standing, meaning that you killed 99 others, okay? It's an incredibly addictive game, but I want to talk about it a little bit just to, by way of simple education. Here's what we know about Fortnite, okay? Number one, what we know is that Fortnite is so addictive. Little dopamine squirts come out when you play a video game. Dopamine is the same chemical that people are exposed to when they're addicted to certain kinds of drugs. So it turns out that in the most recent research, as of this month, 35% of students who play Fortnite have skipped school in order to play with it. Okay? 35%. 20% of adult Fortnite players, because it's addictive for adults also, they've stayed home from work to play. That's basically what the new research is showing, okay? And the most alarming is the following. One is the hergel, because it's violent content, okay? And we know that kids who play this very heavily have an increase in aggressive thoughts and actions. So it's associated with loss of empathy, with loss of the ability to be nosei ba'olam chavero. Okay? But most alarming is that recently, the National Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Children has come out with stark warnings about it, because there's a chat feature that you have to very deliberately try to disable, and isn't so easy necessarily to disable, where adults have been grooming children, including some children in our community, in order to groom them for molestation, okay? And it's happening through the game. So it's literally inviting pedophiles into our living rooms and our kitchens and wherever else our children may be playing these games. And I'm not saying that happens a lot, but it's alarming enough that the National Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Children, which is an organization I've worked very closely with over the years in terms of abuse cases, have put out a major warning about kids playing these games. This is true in general with any kind of game that has a chat function. So it means at the very least, I don't know why any parent would allow their child to play these games given this, but if you're going to allow it, you have to have constant shmira, or you have to have an expert in technology teach you how to shut that off. To me, this is a game changer. We just can't allow it. It's literally not doable. It's literally dine nefashos. Okay, let's move on. Okay. I wanted to talk a little bit about the right age for a smartphone, because it's something that I'm frequently asked about. Many of you know about the program called MUST. MUST, and if not, you should write it down. It's Mothers United to Stall Technology. It was started by Michal Klerer-Zackheim. If you Google it, those of you who are able to Google, okay? Otherwise, get a friend. There's also a phone number that I could share that you could call them directly. What it does, it's a very simple idea. They had mothers join together using WhatsApp, okay? I know this may be problematic for some people, but, and they all say, look, our kids are entering fifth grade, which in Flatbush, which is where it started, is the place where most kids for the first time get a smartphone. All the mothers, okay, sign on, 100% of the mothers in the class sign on through WhatsApp and peer pressure of the mothers to say, I will not buy my child any kind of device. And they did it for a year, and then they say, we'll revisit it next year when our kids are starting sixth grade. Okay, the mothers, and by the way, huge number of girls' schools all around Brooklyn have done it, and now it's spreading around the world. And it's effective, because there's absolutely no peer pressure. The peer pressure now is that absolutely you're giving a pledge not to buy your kid devices, and your kids can't complain. All my friends have it. I'm the only kid in town who doesn't have it. You have proof that nobody else has it. Okay? And just to tell you the obvious, secular people are coming to the conclusion that technology is something that we have to be very careful about. So the people who brought us Google and the people who brought us, Twitter and Facebook and all the other social media, they do not allow, the heads of the companies do not allow their children to have devices. They become screen free. Their schools that they send their children to have not a single computer, not a single device. What do they know that we don't know? They know what we're talking about, that it takes away from the koach hadimyon. They know, the research shows, it takes away from creativity. It takes away from the ability to develop depth. And when you have no stillness, you're not able to develop yourself as a person. And more the secular world is coming to that reality, okay? So that's purely secular. Everything I'm talking to you about today, I'm purposely talking about it from a purely secular standpoint, okay? We're good with that? Okay, let's keep going. Maybe not, okay. So... let me go now to two points that I think are, I have so much I want to say, but I was generously given enough time to do it. Okay? Let me talk about of all the things to talk about, this is the one I'm most worried about. It's something called the online disinhibition effect. It's the fact that when we are online, it could either be because we're using WhatsApp, or it could be, because this isn't really a smartphone. I told the Rabbanim on Friday morning, I sold this to a non-Jew earlier, and I just brought it for today, and then I'm going to throw it out as soon as we finish this talk, okay? No, actually, Waze is going to get me to my next speaking engagement right after this, okay? So here's online disinhibition effect. It's the fact that when you don't have the corrective influence of seeing the hurt look on a person's face when you hurt their feelings, you're much more likely to be cruel, and you're much more likely to do things that you normally wouldn't do in normal face-to-face interaction where you have, you know, the kamayma panim el panim kein leiv ha'adam. So much of that comes through the koach ha'ri'iya, looking straight at a person. You have to see them in the eyes. It's only vayar Moshe b'sivlosam, vayar b'sivlosam, only came by seeing it. And we're told by a number of Mepharshim that Leah didn't fully appreciate the pain she would cause Rachel had she used the simanim until she saw her sister and she felt that pain. And it's all through koach ha'ri'iya. It's all through looking up. This generation, there's a lot of research that shows empathy levels have gone way down. And one of the reasons empathy levels have gone way down is because of the statistics I just shared with you. When you live your life looking down and not looking up, it's very hard to be no se ba'ol. Okay. I'm just going to illustrate this with this story before I go on to one or two concluding points before our 1 o'clock end. Here's the story, okay? Because it's all about the d'oraisa of anas dvarim. And it's so complicated and so easy to miss. A number of years ago, I go to a talk in a Beis Yaakov in a different part of the United States. And I'm sitting there, I was going to be speaking to the staff, and the menahel of the Beis Yaakov tells me, you know, if you were here last night, you would not believe what would have happened. I was in the gym. He said, last night we had the 25th reunion of the women who were here 25 years ago in this Beis Yaakov. We had a very good turnout, and he says, it's amazing how history recreated itself. The former queen bee of our school 25 years ago goes right to the center of the gym. All of her acolytes, all of her chassidim surround her, and they're all being so nice to her and trying to gain her popularity. They're now middle-aged women, he says. Didn't change. Everything recreated itself immediately. And on the outskirts were the people who never quite made it. He says it was like nothing changed in a whole generation. Suddenly, he says, a huge limousine, stretch limousine comes, and a very well-dressed woman gets out. Turns out she's holding a small book in her hands. Nobody knows who she is. Turns out that the driver of the limousine was the pilot of her private plane that she owns. Turns out that she's the head of one of the major Fortune 500 companies, I think a Fortune 100 company. She's a phenomenally wealthy and successful woman. Nobody knows who she is. And she goes out of the limo, goes right to the center of the gym, goes to the former queen bee, throws into her hands the small book, and she says, read. And the woman, thinking she's living in the past, she says, who are you? You don't talk to this woman anymore like that. She said, I said read. She goes to the first page. Page one, she talks about today I came to school. It was Monday morning. I found out that yesterday everybody was invited to the Queensbee house for a get-together. I was the only one not invited. I think tonight is the night I'm going to take those pills I've been saving up. Then she says, read. She goes to the next page. And the next page says, came to school today. All the girls were making fun of the way I was dressed. And then she writes, you know, my family can't afford better clothing. We don't have much money. And I try to do a creative thing to make up for it. And they were all mocking me mercilessly. The derisive of one after another. She read about 10 pages. The Manal told me this is like watching a train wreck in slow motion. After about 10 pages, the former queen bee is crying hysterically. And she says, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. She says, I hear what I did. And all the other women around her says, I'm so sorry. But then she says, and you know something? The former queen bee says, I don't remember any of it. The Manal says she was telling the truth. It was clear to me she didn't remember any of it. And it's then that I understood the Rabbeinu Yona that's so relevant to understanding online disinhibitions. Rabbeinu Yona says the following. He says, why is it that you could do tshuva for being vazeh somebody barabim? You could do tshuva for murder, but you can't do tshuva for shaming somebody in public. This doesn't make any sense. What's the logic of that? He says, because the average person who shames somebody in public has no hakara sachet. They don't know. They don't know it because it's coming from their insecurity. It's coming from some place that has nothing to do with the other person. And when you have no hakara sachet, obviously you can't do tshuva. I never understood it as deeply until I heard this story. But think about today. Think about today. How easy it is for our children, if the most decorated general in recent history, and the top spy in our country falls prey to the online disinhibition effect, what chance do our daughters and sons have of not being nichshol in the avera of shaming others And I see it all the time. I hear it all the time. They do it. They exclude it. Maybe something simple. Maybe a WhatsApp group where they say, you know, we have a long Motzei Shabbos now. Let's together at the local pizza store. And you leave out two or three girls or two or three boys who are a little bit more difficult or a little bit different or a little bit nerdy or whatever you want to call it. And it's the achrayus of every parent here to talk to your kids. It's a deraisa. It's a real deraisa. I mean, there are, I'm sure, many other Isuri Doraisa tied to this that I'm sure the people here could say much better than I can. But we need to understand that that's one of the subtle things that we often miss. Let me end with some recommendations and a story. I'm going to censor a whole lot of stuff that I would love to talk about, but I knew I'd run out of time. So here's number one in terms of recommendations for parents, okay? So in terms of recommendations for parents, we need to, this is worth it. It's worth it. A little bit, I spoke to the Rabbanim about this, a little bit about being in a hurry and empathy. It's very hard to be empathic when we're in a hurry. I shared with Rabbanim an unbelievable study where a bunch of people who were studying in the non-Jewish world, studying to be ministers in the non-Jewish world, and they were about to get a test from their professors on a speech they had to give on how important it is to help somebody they see in need. So it's basically about the Iser Doraisa of Halama. And they did something very simple. As these divinity students are rushing to take the test in another building on campus, they have two psychologists make believe that they're having a heart attack. And one says, "Help me, help me. I think I'm having a heart attack." They're just saying, "Help me, I don't know CPR." And many of the people on their way to give a talk on how there's a chiyuv for hakeim takeim imo, when you see somebody who's in bad shape that way. So what do they say? They say that these people, very high percentage didn't stop. So waiting for them in the other building were these psychologists who said, "Why didn't you stop? Why didn't you say, you're about to give a speech, practice what you preach." And the number one reason they gave for not stopping is that they were in a rush. They said, "We were in a rush." And when you're in a rush, it's hard to be empathic. And we all know what that's like. We have lives filled with stress. And we have so many things on our schedule. And it's very hard when you're in a rush and you have pressure not to answer the phone when you're having dinner with your kids. Or not to take calls and not to spend your time looking down when you should be looking up. And what's so incredibly important is if you just follow the following core recommendations, but keep in mind, I heard this from Moshe Tzvi Weinberg, a beautiful thought, quoting the Baal Shem Tov, who said, "Al pidrush va'avadate mehera." When we say "v'avadate mehera" number of times every day in Kriya Shema, "al pidrush," he says, it means, the Baal Shem Tov said, okay, according to the Pia Zessner, quoting the Baal Shem Tov, it means get rid of the rush in your life. Vavadate mehera, get rid of the rush in your life. Because when you're in a rush, it's going to be very hard to be nosei ba'ol. It's very hard to be there for our children and be there for our spouse, etc. I have so much great stuff on marriage, but I can't come close to what you just heard, so I could safely, without any guilt, skip that. Let me end with a few recommendations on parenting, and then end with a story. Here's the recommendations on parenting. Here's what we have. Some basic things, two easy things to do that are extremely important. One is, don't let your children sleep with their technology. Don't allow it. And you should model for them by not sleeping with technology either. Meaning, you recharge your phones in a public part of the house. If you have them sleeping with technology, you totally lose control over what they're saying. And the typical kids will be up half the night. Kids tell me they just wish their parents had stricter rules. In California, Debbie Fox did a wonderful study where she asked adolescents going to various yeshivas in the California area. She said, when you have teenage children of your own, how are you going to handle the internet differently than your parents did with you? Most of the kids said, I'm going to be stricter. Most of the kids said, if only I could get back all the time I stayed up to 3, 4 in the morning with nonsense, you know, important messages like, you still up? Were you asleep yet? You know, really important stuff. And many of them said, if I could only get those images out of my head that I never should have seen. Another issue that's not for today. So that's recommendation number one. Recommendation number two is obviously, everybody knows it goes without saying, you have to supervise your kids' use, not only with filtering programs, and not only with monitoring programs, where you have that kind of chashdeyu v'chabdeyu approach. What the research shows over and over again, the key to kids having responsible use of technology is to find the balance between smol docha v'mim karebes, authoritative parenting. You find the middle ground between limit setting, which our kids want, while in the context of a good relationship. If you monitor in the context of a good relationship, it makes an enormous difference. And in large-scale studies by the Kaiser Family Foundation, they find, A, kids want it, and B, when you do it, it tends to work. Because kids are looking for it. But the consequences that you have to have, they have to be have the following three ingredients when your kids violate it. Your consequences should be logical, a mida keneged mida thing, unemotional, you can't be angry when you're doing it, and brief. Maybe you'll take technology away from them just for half a day or for a day. And when you do it that way, they're more likely to internalize it. And I'll just end this with an obvious point before I give a concluding story, which is the pasuk in Mishle. Yaser bincha ki yesh tikva vel hamiso al titei nafshecha. Put limits on your kids, there's always hope. And don't worry about their screaming and yelling, because that's part of what we do. That's part of what we have to do to be good parents. In the balance between smol docha v'mim karebes, you need the stronger hand to be bringing close, but you have to have the smol docha, and kids are begging for it. Wherever I go, anywhere in the world, it could be Australia, it could be South Africa, it could be Europe, anywhere in this country or Canada, kids are begging for it. They're begging for it. And you may say, how could it be? I'll give you the medrash on the pasuk I just quoted, on Yaser Bincha. Here's what the medrash says. Kol ha-mosif av yisurim al beno, mosif ha-ben ahava al aviv. The more you put limits on your kids, the more that kid will love you, and I'm seeing that over and over and over again. Kids in my office who complain to their parents when they're older. Okay, so they're older. I'm already in the third generation, at least, of seeing kids. And they'll tell me, why did my father allow me to do this? Why was I allowed to do that? And they have tinnitus on them. Let me end with a story, which I think gets to the heart of this, to the heart of what this is all about. We are such a bracha in terms of what we have. The amount of chesed, the amount of learning, the amount also of bracha that's been unleashed, you know, by the learning and chesed. And, I don't have to tell you, again, I'm about to go to give a talk to Torah Masorah in Brooklyn. It's going to be, there's no way I could find my way there without this, okay? And then I'll get rid of it. Okay, so here's the concluding story. Every few years, I'm privileged to be invited. I have a specialty in the secular world in trauma. Invited to give talks in Frankfurt, Germany. It's talks sponsored by German law that anybody who, any company who benefited from slave labor during World War II, they have to sponsor a program to meet the mental health needs of the ever-dwindling number of survivors still living in Europe and their therapists, mostly Russian Jewish therapists. So the last conference, there was a man who was an older man who had suffered terribly in Auschwitz, And he told me the following. I go over to him, and I tell him, "You were the happiest man I've ever met in my life. His simchas hachayim was unbelievable. I never saw such simcha. Unbelievable simcha." And I go over to him and I say, "Listen," I said, "you know, we just spent 3 days together. I've met you in other conferences. You're so happy, yet you told me how you suffered. Where does the simcha come from, given what you went through?" He looked a little embarrassed, and he was very articulate. And he went over with me how it's selection. It would be 3-4 in the morning, sub-freezing temperature. You'd go outside. If you were too slow, the machine guns would come, the dogs would come out. If you fell down, the guns would come out. And he said, "I've often thought, what got me through those horrible mornings to the point that I survived to the liberation? What got me through?" And he said, "I know the answer." He said, "I'll tell you the answer." He said, "I developed the ability to feel the warmth of my father's hands on my head when he benched me every Friday night, and to smell the sweetness of his breath when he bent down to kiss me. You want to know what got me through? It's that bracha." About a year later, I'm in South Africa, and there was a man there who was very, very wealthy, an incredible Baal Tzedaka, who I spent a lot of time with, a lot of the programs there that the chief rabbi, the Rabbi Goldstein, had asked me to be involved in, were in his house. Very generous man. And I didn't know anything about his history. I knew that he had an amazing art collection, not only just a mansion, he's one of the wealthiest men in that part of the world. And I told over this story, because it had happened not too long before. He comes over to me, and he's crying. And I say to him, what's wrong? He said, "I don't know if you know, I'm a survivor. I also went through all this. I don't like to talk about it, but I'm also a survivor." And he says, "David, you've seen my house. You've seen my car collection. You've seen my art, and you know the business I have. You know what I have." Right? We just learned Yesh Li Rav versus Yesh Li Kol. Okay? And he was a real Yesh Li Kol kind of person. He says, "You know what?" He says, "I would give it all up, everything I own, the house, the art, the business, everything, just for the chance once to walk to shul with my mother on one side and holding my father's hand on the other. Just once." He said, "I'm not going to be a pig about it, just one way. One way walk to shul. I'd give it all up for that." And that's my parting message, is we have to remember what a gift it is to have our children, what a gift it is to have our grandchildren, what a gift it is to be able to live the kind of amazing life with the kind of values we have. And we can't let it be stolen by forces that we just don't pay attention to. So thank you, everybody, and this has been an amazing opportunity.